Sorry, everyone. I was trying to start with the Iconoclast intro, but I didn't realize that my damn mic was muted. So I apologize. That would have been a really cutesy way to start, but there we go. Hold on a second. We're going to do it anyway. We're going to soldier on with this. Here we go.
Oh, here we go. Oh dear.
All right. So with that farce done, somebody somebody said in the live chat, start with Dan's intro. So I thought, yeah, that's a cool idea, but I fucked it up. I apologize to everyone. So okay. Here we are. Welcome back to Millennial 2019. And I am now here with Dan, the Iconoclast. Welcome, Dan. Welcome, Mr. Iconoclast.
Thank you. Very nice to be back. I always enjoy Millennial. Third year in a row. So I think I'm a regular now. I enjoy it very, very much. And don't worry about the intro, Woz. It's not your fault that I have the best intro on YouTube in history. It's fine.
Damn your eyes!
There's a lot of clamor for it. It's okay. It's okay.
Hope everyone in the chat
is doing well. Merry Christmas to everybody. And I hope you all enjoy this upcoming stream.
All right. Well, let's try to make it as thrilling and exciting and life-affirming and thought-provoking as possible.
Indeed, indeed.
So, okay, Dan, I think everyone knows that about the Iconoclast and the Iconoclast magazine, but we'd like to talk about that briefly just now.
Sure. So I have a YouTube channel, obviously. I don't know how many subs I have now, 200 and something thousand. Although, you know, I guess we'll get into this later. Censorship has been rampant on YouTube. So
217,000, I just checked.
Oh, well, that's more than I thought, actually. I thought I had less than that because YouTube, I've been teetering around 210,000 for the last 6 months because of various YouTube algorithmic changes. And I'm sure we'll get into that later on.
I just want to say, just off the bat, you're the third person, at least, that I've had on already who has been hit by algorithm suppression. Sargon and Black Pigeon and now you. That alone, I mean, for God's sake, that is just such an illustration of what's going on. And we know it's definitely, this is not some sort of paranoia. They're obviously doing this to us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so obvious. It's so blatant. And earlier this year, I had my entire channel deleted. Let's not forget.
I was going to bring that up.
I was very lucky to get it back, along with Way of the World. But people weren't so lucky. James Alsop, who you've had on Millennial this year already, the guy, he just got fucked. And it's a shame because he was doing good stuff. But, you know, this is a thing. It's going to happen more and more. And now on YouTube, I'm not comfortable. I wake up every morning thinking, okay, this could be the day. And, you know, I guess I've become emotionally detached from my own channel, which is a bit sad, but it's just the way it is. And I think other people can relate to that. Maybe even you, Woz, because I think you've expressed your you know, you think it's going to happen to you very, very soon.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I've said that. I mean, I don't want to go on about this because, you know, I do have a reputation for going on about this stuff. But, yeah, I do feel that I don't really see myself as a YouTuber. I don't think of myself that that's my job or whatever. I just think, that zoom in was what's what happens when you try to, when you focus the lens. I just don't, you can't afford to. I think the attitude you had when you got banned was, I think, the correct attitude where you said, even if I do, I've lodged the appeal, even if it works and I get the channel back, my focus is no longer on being a YouTuber. You don't define yourself in that way because you can't afford to anymore. It's not for anyone else, but it's perfectly safe. I remember thinking this. I was making the point to a friend a few months ago that ordinary people don't have these worries to think about. You know, you could lose everything. It's just, it wouldn't even occur to them. Well, why would you get banned from YouTube or whatever? But for us, this is an ever-present threat. So, you can't afford, you've got to have some sort of detachment from it for your own good, as demonstrated by me last September, October. So, there you go.
Yes, it is what it is, you know, to use an overused phrase in Britain. It is what it is. It's you can't really do anything about it. I guess One of the biggest mistakes I made in the first 2 years of my channel was being very, very connected to my channel in an emotional sense. I thought, listen, this channel's my life. If something happens to it, I'm going to be depressed or whatever.
You were in a similar situation to me, and forgive me for saying that this might be a bit personal, but I think you had never... I was in this position where I had never really achieved anything. I'd got a degree at art college, but other than that, I hadn't really done anything in my...
Sorry. I mean, that is an achievement, degree at art college.
Well, I'm saying it just for completionism's sake. You know? it's not something I'm dreadfully proud of. But anyway, it was just, other than that, I hadn't really done anything until I hadn't really achieved something. I'd started things, but they hadn't gone anywhere, or I hadn't finished them. Millennial was the first time that I thought that I really solidly achieved something in adulthood. And so, of course, it was, leaving aside every other reason why it would matter to me, there's that reason. And I think you're in a similar position where you sort of drifted and didn't really know what you were going to do. And then you created the Iconoclast and it took off. And that was presumably something that you... defined yourself by at a personal level.
Yeah, it all happened by accident. And I feel like a lot of people in our position, they have similar stories. They just wanted to get something off their chest. And then, you know, 2 years later, they find themselves in the place that they're in. And, you know, it's really funny, actually, because like you, I tried my best at so many things before I started this YouTube channel. I was trying to make a career in the media. I had several positions in London on TV sets, for example, and freelance jobs, and they never really worked out, but I was really grafting, and it was getting nowhere. I just felt like I was hitting a wall. And then I started this YouTube channel one day, just like saying, oh, fuck it, let me complain about something. And then it just took off from there. It was effortless in a way. And I'm not saying that I don't put effort into my channel, because I clearly do, but it was, you know, it's weird. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It was just something that came naturally in a way.
Oh, and, absolutely. I mean, I've told this story many times, but to tell it very briefly, I started the channel thinking it would be about 20 videos and 200 subscribers in total. That's what I thought I would get. I'd top out at 200 or 300 subscribers. I didn't think it would go anywhere at all. I had nothing to lose. There were no expectations, no pressure, no sense of being a figure in a community with responsibilities and duties, nothing. And nothing whatsoever. I was just a nobody. And that's how it started. It started with absolutely no intentions or expectations whatsoever, which I think was, well, that's just the way it was. I mean, whether that was naive of me or not is kind of academic at this point.
Yeah, and it makes all this censorship even more hilarious, actually, because our opponents, they go on about someone like Hope Not Hate, who you did a really good speech about recently. You put the video up on your channel. I really enjoyed that video.
Thank you.
Great editing as well, by the way. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. A lot of work, a huge amount of work went into that video. So if people could share it far and wide, I'd be very grateful. But I have to say that most of the editing was not by me. It was by a friend of mine who goes Metasite. And he is looking for work. You know, if you've got editing work that you need done, he's available. So he's very skilled. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, Hope Not Hate, on the subject of them, every year they release their State of Hate report. I think it's every January, right? And I remember last year, I was quite annoyed that I wasn't included, to be honest with you. I might be included this year, next year, right?
That did baffle me. There were people, you know, I got this full fucking page, even though I hadn't done really much last in 2018. But yeah. other people only got a paragraph, and some people weren't even mentioned. And I thought, this is weird. It's almost like they're resting, Hope Not Hate, are resting on their laurels, and they're not really realizing that this movement is growing all the time.
Yeah, what really annoyed me is Count Dankula, who you've just had on previously. He was included. I wasn't. I was genuinely pissed off about this. Not that I want to be attacked by Hope Not Hate, but you know, Dankula's a shit poster, and I do what I do. But maybe I'm included next month. Who knows? But
I suspect you will be. I suspect that. Well, some predictions for the Hope Not Hate State of Hate Report 2019. I think that you'll be mentioned. I think that On the Offensive will be mentioned.
Oh, definitely. Hugh.
Maybe Keith Woods. I don't know. I think it'll probably be more extensive. And I think probably they won't have given me a full page spread again. Because I've talked about it publicly, about how it was sort of like, I liked it. So I think just for that reason alone, they'll not do it again. Just to annoy me, maybe not. To spite me.
Maybe not, but you know, the funniest thing about that report is they list all of these people that we're familiar with. You know, there's you, there's Laura Towler, Morgoth, among others. And they list them in this report as if they're some sort of organization in themselves. It's like, these are like far right hate preachers. And it's just, these are individuals with microphones and a laptop, basically. It's not like Hope Not Hate, who are funding out the arse.
They have a budget. And their headquarters is in the center of London, one of the most expensive squares in London that you could possibly have your headquarters in. And yet, look at their social media presence. Look at the footprint that they have. Mm. No, it's completely astroturfed. But yeah, these are just ordinary people who are having an impact because they're saying they're addressing concerns that many, many people have. And as for it being an organization, you know, that's just preposterous. But again, they speak about us as if it's funny because I do believe on the one hand, yes, we clearly do have a social impact. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't be talking about us at all. But at the same time, I think the only people who read the Hope Not Hate State of Hate report are probably a small number of Antifa and us.
Yes, we are their biggest audience. Like, the State of Hate report is aimed at us. Like, we love this shit.
Yeah, it's like a yearly, what's been going on this year? And, you know, it's a sort of community newsletter.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? But, you know, it's so funny to me because, you know, they talk about us as if, like you said, as if we are sort of connected behind the scenes and as if we are running some sort of organization. But the truth is, we're all just individuals. We all kind of know each other either directly or through other people. We're all familiar with each other in some sense, but it's not like we're on the same page on everything. It's not like we're colluding with each other to try and bring down the institutions of the left and whatever else. We're just normal people who have a voice and we want to share our voice and express our opinions. And they have a huge problem with that. And the reason why they have a huge problem with that is because they know that we have the popular opinions. You know, despite what they say, despite what the mainstream media says, the average British citizen doesn't like mass immigration, wants Brexit done, to use Boris's catchphrase. And, you know, maybe we can dress up the arguments in flowery language and maybe go a bit further than the average person could do. But they agree with us. We have the popular opinions, and Hope Not Hate can't handle that. All they have to do is smear and slander and try and attack us. And I take great joy in that, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. I think that the fact that they talk about us is encouraging for me, because I think, well, we're kind of, as someone said, we're living rent-free in their heads. I mean, I always think it's, I'm a wee bit reluctant to talk about Hope Not Hate publicly in like casual stuff like this, because I don't want them to think that they are more important to us than they actually are. As far as I'm concerned, they're just a bunch of fucking lying losers who are completely ideological, very dishonest, ruthless, vicious, and irresponsible. And yeah, that's all. And they're an occasional irritation, but that's all they are to us. More than anything else, I just find them funny. I find Nick Lowles funny. I find Joe Mulhall funny, this gormless hipster. Matt Collins is just a complete fucking loser of a guy. I mean, I just think they're three tragic guys who employ absurd young pretty boys to do things. But I mean, it's like a bunch of losers who happen to have a budget. And that's
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah, I'm like you. I find them funny. I think, like you said, they're just fucking gay. That's all they are. Like Hope Not Hate, fucking gay. That's all I think they are.
I do love the idea that in their headquarters, it's just constantly blaring disco music. that you have. It's part of that proviso of working there is you have to be dancing to disco. You have to be good at dancing to disco.
Yeah, right. They're all wearing like flares and stuff. Yeah, I want to imagine that. That's great. To be honest, I want to join Hope Not Hate now with that image. That's great. I'd like to be a part of that. But no, I mean it's really funny and on a personal level, you know, I've just, like I said before, I took this a bit too seriously, but this year I've just decided, you know, it is what it is. It's funny. It's a game at the end of the day. And Morgoth, he always says, just enjoy the fight, and I'm starting to enjoy the fight. I remember when when Morgoth earlier this year, he made that infamous video about Stormzy, about, you know, and it went viral because Morrissey posted on his website and whatever. You know, Morgoth said, you just enjoy the fight. It's hilarious, and I agree. It just enjoy it, guys. It's all a game. It's all a game. And we're coming
well,
out on top.
I mean, of course, he was his sorry to interrupt. His adversary in that was Billy Bragg, who is closely associated with Hope Not Hate, and yeah, exemplifies the absurdity of it all. He lives in a huge house, and he's a fucking socialist, supposedly. I mean, again, it's the classic thing. You want all these migrants, asylum seekers to come here, refugees, fucking house them in your mansion, or shut up, basically. Really, I mean, seriously, it's absurd. So
yeah, we'll get into this in this stream, I imagine. But the whole celebrity thing, you talked about it with Black Pigeon Speaks yesterday, actually. But the whole celebrity thing is really, it really sums up where we are now. The divide that we find ourselves engaging in, the elite versus the common folk. And Billy Bragg, I had no idea who the fuck he was until that Stormzy thing. I had never heard of the guy, never heard any of his songs, but he lives in a mansion and he's a Corbynista. I just thought, who is like the male version of Lily Allen, you know? And it's just like, I just found it funny. All these people are hilarious. And now after the election, you got Hugh Grant and Steve Coogan and God knows who else. All these morons just flipping out. You just have to laugh at it because, you know, this decade, as we'll get into, has been the decade of division in a way. And this is so symbolic of that division, these celebrities versus the common people. And I just find it absolutely hilarious. So come on, Hope Not Hate, put me in your State of Hate report next month. Please do it.
Give him a full page spread. Do it.
Yeah, go. Please fucking do it. Yeah. Please. Come on.
He's earned it. So, okay, let's get into the topic at hand then, which is this decade, how things have changed. I think you've got some ideas on that topic.
Yeah, well, I think putting aside the political events that we all know and we're all aware of, and I think everyone watching will know my opinions on all these political events. Aside from that, I think this has been the decade, I'm going to call it the viral decade. So, but before this stream, I did a couple of Google searches, just basic searches. You know, what happened in the 2010s? What's been going on? And a lot of these lists that I found didn't really include real life, earth shattering milestones of the human race. They that went viral on the internet. You know, most of these lists were just made up of, you know, in 2013, everyone was planking. Or everyone was doing the Harlem Shake or the Ice Bucket Challenge or whatever.
Tombstoning, that was a thing as well.
Yeah, like all this shit. Logan Paul from YouTube filmed a dead guy in a forest in Japan. Like, all of these lists were just filled with these viral videos that were on YouTube or Twitter or wherever the hell they were hosted. And, you know, it is the viral decade. You know, we've become so entrenched in the online world, in the virtual world that, you know, it's a bit of it's a divide. Everyone's living online and the real world kind of passes everyone by without everyone realizing what's going on. You know, this includes social media, obviously, that's the obvious example, but it's really kind of worrying, actually, how many people just put so much stock in Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, you know, Gangnam Style, that was another one on the list. And, you know, the real world continues chugging along and people are kind of missing out on it and they're not participating. It's quite sad in a way. So that's the biggest takeaway I found from this decade.
Well, you could also use the word memes. You know, memes have become a thing. I mean, I know that they existed prior to this decade, but I never heard about it. I didn't know what they were until about, I don't know, probably when I started my channel in 2014. I didn't really know what it was all about. I didn't know what 4chan was. I'd never really heard of it until 2013 when I watched a Dave Isserini video about it. And I still didn't get into it. It's not my kind of thing. which is not to disparage it. It's just not my kind of thing. But yeah, this decade has been a strange thing where you get these momentary crazies and everyone talks about it for like 3 days and then that's it and it's on to the next thing. Remember earlier this year, there was that thing. It was an advert for some TV show in America and it was a black guy saying, it's time to kill a few Nazis or punch a few Nazis. I can't remember what it was. But that was a meme that then spread around. And then there was the other one of the from the Gillette advert. The guy, he sees the woman walking past. He goes, oh, hey, and starts to approach her. And then a black guy launches an intervention to stop him. Then that became a meme. And there are all these things that you then forget. And by the end of the time the end of the year comes, you've forgotten just how many memes you've seen and been part of and spread throughout the year. But there are loads of them, and they are hilarious. I mean, it's something that, you know, I do enjoy very much about this, the age that we live in. And so I don't like, a lot of folk on our side are very negative about the age we live in for, I mean, understandable reasons. And, you know, I'm certainly not immune from this myself, of course. But I also think a lot of it is, you know, people sort of disapprove of it for the sake of disapproving of it in some ways.
Oh, I totally agree. I'm not necessarily massively against it or for it. I just, you know, that's the world we live in. But, you know, you look around at the, especially the political climate we live in now, and everything is so divisive. Everything is so combative, and we always complain about people who get offended at everything, people who get radicalized on the basis of wanting to show their virtue. And if you go back at the beginning of the decade, I remembered, can anyone remember Kony 2012? Like, that was, in my opinion, the first viral political campaign that radicalized the youth in a way where they wanted to be virtuous and show how virtuous they were and show how caring they were on a mass scale. And it turned out to be a massive con, obviously, but it was a sign of things to come. Kony 2012, you know, we need to oppose this guy that nobody's ever heard of in a country that nobody cares about at all, on an issue that nobody knows anything about, but we need to do it because we just need to. And, you know, put stickers up on buildings, put links in your Facebook page, do all of these things. And if anyone criticizes you for doing this, they just don't care about children or, you know, whatever. It was the first example of this totally online virtuous assault that if you weren't on board with it, you were basically an evil piece of shit.
Well, I mean, Facebook now has this, or has had for several years now, has had a button for it's marked call to action. So, and I remember the first time I saw that, realizing that they were now seeing activism as being an integral part of the platform. Where so, and inevitably, it's for left wingers to use to rally each other into doing something against the right, against the far right, against tradition, against hierarchy, whatever it might be. But that was something that they were now seeing as so, it's so commonplace that now we'll just have a button to do it, call to action.
Yeah.
And I saw in another one too, I think on YouTube or Twitter, that they're doing these new terms and it's the same term was used, the same expression, call to action.
Yeah, it's like call to action, but what is the action? Like, what are you doing, really? Sharing a few links, maybe putting a few posters on lampposts, like, you know, it's the illusion of you actually doing something for a cause that you want to get behind because everyone needs a cause to fight for. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing about the left, right? They want to imagine themselves as fighting for a grand moral cause, because if they're not doing that, then they're really useless, they're worthless. And they'll never be satisfied because, you know, this utopia that they want to build doesn't exist. It's impossible. So there always has to be a cause to fight for. So these people get, you know, I don't want to use the word again, but radicalized by these online campaigns. And, you know, any excuse to show how moral they are, they'll get on board with it. And Kony 2012 was the first big example that I remember. I was in university at the time, and I think it was me and a few friends who called bullshit on this whole campaign. We were like, well, hang on a second. Who is this charity? Who is Kony? Nobody's heard of this guy before, ever. Child soldiers in Uganda. But I mean, what's that got to do with us? You know, there's lots of heinous things going on around the world. Well, why is this that important? And I remember people in my immediate year would just tell me, you need to, you know, you need to grow a heart. You need to grow something in your brain that allows you to feel empathy for children in Uganda. And I'm like, well, you don't know a fucking thing about this. And now we see what's going on in the world now, especially with Twitter. And you see this mindset just, you know, amplified by 100 times. And I think you can trace it back to down then, back in 2012.
Somebody in the chat mentioned the free Tibet thing. And I can't remember when that happened, but I do remember it. It was a fashionable cause. And again, it was really left wingers who wanted freedom for Tibet. But I can't remember what what was even going on. I can't remember what the whole thing was about. It was before I was politically aware, politically cognizant. So yeah. I can't talk about that, but I do remember it being a fashionable cause, and you'd see people with the T-shirts on and stuff like that. Yeah, the Dalai Lama, who, of course, has now earned the left's disfavor for comments he made, I believe, last year, about how Europe belongs to Europeans, which is obviously insane.
Yes, I mean, the Dalai Lama is now a white nationalist hero, which is very funny indeed. But yeah, I mean, I think this decade has been defined by little things like that, and the huge move from the real world into the virtual world. And but I think there is some hope coming out of this. At the end of the decade, I feel we've experienced and seen a backlash to this. I think more and more people are trying to return to reality in a way. And you know, if we take the British election from the past couple of weeks as an example. Every Labour supporter on Twitter was so sure that they were going to win the election, and they didn't. They got destroyed. It's because they were involved. They existed in a bubble. You know, they existed in a world where everyone thought the same thing as them. This small section of the population on a social media site, and they allowed themselves to think that that was reality, that that was the mood of the country, and it isn't.
Well, they banned everyone who disagreed with them so that they would never encounter disagreement.
Exactly. And I think I heard Black Pigeon on your on Millennial yesterday. He was saying that the celebrity world and the celebrity virtue signalers and the way that reality completely disproves what they say and the worldview that they hold, it's a really motivating factor for regular people, because these so-called elites, these celebrities, Robert De Niro, Steve Coogan, whoever, they say one thing, but the real world does the complete opposite. And it's a rejection of this worship that these public figures have had for so long in Western society. And I think the next decade is going to be just a continuation of that. And the next generation, what are they called? The Zoomers?
Yes.
Generation Z? Yeah, I think they're going to be at the forefront of that. I think they're not like millennials, these Zoomers. They're very, very different. Very, very different indeed.
How do you mean?
Well, they seem, millennials, and you and I, millennials, when we were growing up, we were, I don't know about you, but in school, I was always told that, you know, it's not the winning that counts. It's just the taking part, and to boil it down. I think the Zoomers are told the same thing, but they just don't believe it. Like, I believed it when I was a kid. I thought, yo, yeah, I'm going to grow up. I can be whatever I want to be. You know, I wanted to be a filmmaker when I was younger, and I tried to make that happen. Didn't work because nobody explained to me the realities of that industry. Nobody explained to me that, okay, Dan, if you want to work in that industry, maybe going to university to sit behind a desk for 3 fucking years isn't a good idea. Maybe you should actually go out into the real world and try and do something yourself. Nobody said that to me. People were like, you just have to apply yourself. in an academic sense, and you'll be okay. It's not the case. And I think that especially the Zoomers I see on YouTube, for example, they're not like that. Obviously, I'm not speaking for all of them, but they seem to be a lot more realistic and maybe a bit more cynical. Maybe that's a thing, but I think they're just a bit more realistic, and they've seen what's happened to us, the millennials, and they're kind of going another way. And I think that's really exciting, actually.
I think that, yeah, the millennial generation does exemplify a lot of degeneracy and cluelessness and misfortune, you know, feckless decision making. I'm part of that. Not just part of that generation, but I do exemplify certain things in various ways. I'm not going to run away from that. But I think that younger people do see this, and they some of them think, fuck that. But then others think, you know, Generation Z seems to be very split down the middle, and the other half of them are just insane. You know, they're the non-binary gender fluid kind of types who are completely bought into that. So then this is what other people have told me and what I see. I mean, you see them all the time, you know, on social media, just driveling, spouting the stuff that their teacher has said and that they simply believe because their teacher said it. So, you know, they are as stupid as young people have always been.
Oh, of course.
They just have the edifying example of the millennials to learn from if they so choose.
Yeah, and of course the okay boomer meme is very popular within that generation. And I mean, it's almost like just a signal of, yeah, we understand where the older generations went wrong. We're not going to do that. But you are right. It is a generation of two extremes. I don't know if you've downloaded the app TikTok. It gets a lot of hate. It gets a lot of shit. But it's a very interesting app. I mean, it's full of crap, obviously, like most of these apps are. But you do find people on that app, either, like you said, Colin, there either are kids who are full on with the diversity stuff, or they're the complete opposite, and they're saying it's all bullshit, and they're saying, you know, Donald Trump's really cool, actually, I like him a lot, you know, if you don't like that, fuck me, you know, it's very combative, it's a very divisive generation, and I think, you know what, if something isn't divisive, it's not interesting to me. So I think we've got a lot to look forward to, actually. I just have a huge point of shame being a millennial. You know, I'm a self-hating millennial. I mean, well, it's a shame, isn't it?
Is there some other kind of millennial?
Well, yeah, I mean, it goes both ways, doesn't it? You know, the self-hating millennial are, on one hand, the reporter who works for Vice magazine. And on the other hand, you know, it's people like us who realize, like, we've been led down a wrong path here, and we need to kind of fix it. But I don't know how we got onto generations, but it's you know, I think the next decade is going to be very, very interesting in terms of Generation Z and how we as millennials kind of accommodate them in a way, because it's going to be very hostile, very hostile. You know, They've got the okay boomer meme, but what if they have the okay millennial meme, you know, in a few years' time? You know, what are we going to do about that?
That's definitely going to happen. I mean, you know, it's depressing, you know, because I still conceive of myself as a young guy. I'm sure you do as well. But yeah, there are people who see us as old, and, you know, it's like fucking hell. But of course, you know, when we were their age, we saw people this age as pretty old, you know, or at least older than us. So of course they do that. I shouldn't talk too much about this because they'll just start fucking doing it all the time, you know, just to annoy us. But it is a thing. And again, I can't blame them for thinking of millennials as a bunch of losers and idiots, because so much of what I see among my age group and what I've always seen, in adulthood, is just stupidity and, you know, gormlessness. Idealism, lack of common sense, lack of practicality, and again, I'm guilty of this myself. I mean, I did actually make a video because people were asking me to do an autobiographical video where I just talked about how I ended up doing such a depressing channel as Millennial Woes in its first year. It was an extremely dark, slow-paced, miserable channel, which I don't regret at all. I'm not decrying that. But people were asking me to do a video where I talked about how I became that. And I thought that's a really interesting thing. And I could tell the story of basically all the mistakes I made along the way that led me to this situation where I was in a room for 10 years on my own. And I did film it. And I think it was like, it was long. It was like 3 hours long. And I did it in three bits. I did the 3 hour thing, telling the chronology, and then another bit analyzing the mistakes that I had made. And then another video analyzing the character tendencies that had led to those mistakes. So yes. it was a really good thing. I was proud of it, but I thought, no, for various reasons, I didn't upload it. This was in 2017 was a very good year for my channel, but there were actually a lot of extra things that I started, but didn't publish or didn't complete. It was an extremely busy and productive year for me. And this is one of the things that never got published. I might publish it. I don't know, but it was very, I revealed a lot about my life in it, my history, my personal history up until that point. I mean, a lot of stuff has happened since then, ironically, but yeah, that would have been a very good demonstration of millennial stupidity. All of the idealism that led me down in ultimately towards disaster, towards personal disaster. So I do kind of think, maybe I should publish it.
I think it would be good. I mean, getting personal like that is always great for an audience to listen to. Just out of interest, what were some of the reasons that you feel like your life went in the way it did? If you could just boil it down.
Oh, well, the various mistakes that I made. Well, for example, we're going to art college. That was a mistake. Yeah. Other things that I won't go into now because I can't remember all of them, and I don't want to go in. It's more interesting to talk about the mistakes where. Okay. One of the mistakes that was consistent was that I hoped for the best. I just hoped for the best.
Yeah.
And I did that a lot. And I can't remember if I characterized that as a mistake or a character tendency, one or the other. But that was one of them. That was a massive thing. And I see that all the time with millennials. And I think that that's something that Generation Z seem to do a lot less of. They seem to be far more, as you said, realistic, practical. I think with the millennials, like if you look at Occupy, if you look at Antifa, a lot of it is, and even on our side, you know, the alt-right in 2016, that kind of thing, there are a characteristic of millennials seems to be to just hope for the best and not be aware and of problems that could occur further down the line and not prepare for them. I think that's definitely a millennial thing and just sort of a naive idealism.
Yeah, that's a good point, because when I was in my early 20s, I did have this overarching mindset that it doesn't really matter what I do, it's all going to work out fine in the end. I genuinely believe that. And, you know, obviously that's my fault for thinking that, but I was informed by everyone around me that that was the way to think. You know, everyone at university, all my lecturers in high school before that, I was always told that, you know, like I said before, you can be whatever you want to be. And don't, you know, forget about hard work, forget about sacrifice, forget about putting yourself on the line and you know, really going the full mile to achieve what you want to achieve. As long as you have the positive mindset, it's going to work out for you. And it's just not the way it is. Now, optimism's great. Positivity is great. And that's what we need more of in our movement right now. But it has to be practical. It has to be realistic optimism. And that's something I think the millennials just don't have. They just have this, like you said, naivety, this idealism, this altruism in a way, where they think that, you know, we are who we are. We're doing the right thing just because we are. And that's not the way it is. And the coming generations aren't like that, in my opinion.
I think the millennials are going to pay for this dearly. You've made this point in several videos on your channel, and I've definitely talked about it, where, you know, you can get through your teens and your 20s just fucking around. But when you're 30 and your life hasn't gone anywhere and you haven't built anything, And there you don't know how you would even do that. There's nothing in your life that would help you to achieve something and get somewhere. Like, you don't know how to talk to women. You don't know how to pay the bills, how to budget, how to get a mortgage. Your job is shit. There are no promotion prospects. When you get to that position, it's fucking depressing. You know, it's a very sobering experience to realize, oh my God, my youth is kind of over. And some people would call me old or middle aged now, and I haven't done much, and my future is completely uncertain. That is a terrifying position to be in, for men and women for different reasons. So I think a lot of millennials are going to just hit that and are hitting that wall now.
Again, yeah, I mean, when did the millennial generation begin? Like, how old is the oldest millennial?
1982, so yeah,
37. Okay, fine. So I was born in 1990, so I'm 20. I'm 30 next year. And what's really surprised me and shocked me, actually, is older people, you know, like 35, 36, 37-year-olds, who are, you know, workplace professionals in whatever they're doing, whatever job they have. Something that's really, really shocking to me is how little they've prepared for life, actually. So very, very few of them have any savings whatsoever. They're living paycheck to paycheck. Some of them have like £100 in the bank. So if they lose their job, I mean, that's them fucked. It's over for them. They'll have to sign on the dole. And the concept of saving money is alien to them. And I guess we can link this to the highly consumerist society we live in.
Yes.
The materialism that we're all obsessed with. I was having a conversation with someone the other day who is in this bracket. You know, they've got about £150 in the bank. They work 9 to 5 in an office job. And they were saying, oh, you know, it's been really hard to pay my bills this month. And I said, why? What's been going on? And they said, well, you know, I earn this amount of money at work, blah, blah, blah. And of course, I bought an Xbox. And I'm thinking, did you have to buy the Xbox? Did you have to buy the Xbox? You can't pay your water bill, but you're buying an Xbox One. It's just, you know, priorities are all out of sync. And I think, you know, Black Friday, for example, I can't remember that being a thing when I was a kid, but now it's every year, it's a huge event. And you see the videos online of people fighting in PC world, trying to buy laptops or whatever. And I think this does define this decade as well, this hyper-consumerism, hyper-materialism that our generation especially are so consumed with.
Absolutely. I think that a lot of people do indeed, I mean, it's a big cliche, but it's true that a lot of people define themselves by what they can buy, what they consume, and really nothing else. And
yeah.
And so you end up with this ridiculous situation where you're just constantly spending whatever money you have in order to keep up with the Joneses, who are your other millennial friends who are buying pointless stuff. It's definitely a thing. It's definitely a thing that is engendered by consumerist society.
Yeah, and I think, what year was the iPhone released? This day?
It's funny you should mention that, because I actually looked this up just the other night, and yet I can't remember. I think it was 2008 or 9.
Right, so like the tail end of last decade, beginning of this decade sort of thing. Yeah. But, I mean, one thing you can't deny is the Apple and Apple products have become just this social credit score, really. You know, if you don't own an Apple product, if you don't have an iPhone, the latest iPhone, then you're not shit. I have a family member who, whenever a new iPhone is released, he's waiting in line the night before, you know, literally in a queue around the store, so he can get in at opening time the next morning and buy a new iPhone, which isn't that different to the one he's already got.
And this
and
is
it's like, what the fuck are you doing, mate?
It puts into my mind the awful image of that guy watching the Star Wars trailer and just in this state of ecstatic disbelief at the pleasure and the range of emotions that it's igniting in him.
Oh,
and you just think, this is an absolutely tragic collection of atoms in front of me, who his life is utterly empty.
Yeah, oh my god. I mean, you had to mention Star Wars, Colin. I mean, fuck me. Like
the new film comes out
today. Oh my, I mean, I haven't seen the new one, but I know what happens. I've seen leaks and it's just fucking terrible. But you know, the best thing about these terrible Star Wars films, if I can go on a tangent for a second. Yeah, the best thing about these new films is all the YouTube videos that get released ripping them apart. That's what I enjoy more.
I didn't watch the last season of Doctor Who, but I watched a lot of review videos off it. And
yeah.
it was interesting. I think I actually talked about this on Last Millennial, actually. But anyway, go on. I don't watch the things itself yet. I might suffer through it. I don't know. But I have watched the reviews, and it's interesting to see.
Yes, well, the thing about these review channels, though, these film review channels, and they've always got a niche of being about pop culture, like geek culture. It's always a guy, slightly overweight with a beard, and behind him is just a shelf of toys. You know, like that's his background. All these plastic toys from Marvel and Star Wars and things like that, and they're all complaining about how bad the films are. And I'm like, well, you know, it doesn't really matter how good the film is or how bad it is because Disney, Star Wars, Lucasfilm, whatever it is, they've got your money because you've bought all this shit that's standing behind you. You are a corporate shill for this thing that you apparently hate so much. And it's like, where's this self-awareness gonna kick in? When are these people gonna realize that they are contributing to this snake that they desperately want to cut the head off? They've got to take responsibility for what they hate so much and what they've created, in a sense. Now, we could get in a conversation about whether Disney and Star Wars really care about profits or whether they're just pushing an agenda. I think we talked about that last year, you and I. Social media.
This is a very interesting thing because a lot of, like, you know, several people that I've had on Millennial this year already they're still of the mind that it's about profit and money. I don't think it is. I think the performance of Star Wars, Doctor Who, Star Trek shows that it's really not about money anymore.
Exactly. And you know, these big franchises, these huge popular franchises that are ingrained in Western culture at this point, if you release a Star Wars film, no matter what, it's going to pay for itself. It's going to pay for its production budget no matter what, but just because it's a popular franchise. What really is the problem is the messaging they put in it. And I agree. They don't care about profit because it's going to pay for itself. It's just a vehicle for them to push whatever they want to push. And the most interesting thing about the Star Wars movies is, you know, the core fan base of Star Wars was always white Western men. I mean, nobody can deny that. Science fiction in general has always been a white Western man thing. But Disney came along and said, you know what, that's not inclusive enough. fuck the white guy. Fuck the people who like this the most. We're going to try and get everyone involved in this. And it doesn't work. So you piss off your core fan base. But at the same time, this core fan base are hanging on to the hope that it's still going to be the thing that they love so much. And they go and pay money and whatever.
And at first they go along with this as well. And
of course,
until it reaches a certain threshold. And then it's like, oh, you're really fucking us over.
Yes. And another thing is that the people who aren't ready to admit that the thing they love so much has gone off the rails, they make excuses for it. They say, well, it's not that bad. And they invent plot points to try and explain how shit things are. Like they say, well, this happened in the film because this is in the lore. And in the canon, this happened like 20 years ago. So this makes total sense. And you're all bigots and, bloody sexist or whatever. And it's just like, you're getting played, buddy. You're getting played. Like, this is just propaganda at this point. And the Marvel films, to a lesser extent, I've never been a big fan of Marvel. I can't really recall many films that I've seen. But I remember watching the last big Marvel film. I think it was called Endgame. And there was a point at the end where all the female superheroes grouped together in the final battle. And it was like, oh, here's girl power. And they started shitting up the enemies. I'm like, Christ alive. Are people going to buy this? Really? I mean, this is how far we are. And, you know, pop culture, it is another avenue into just degenerating the people like us, really, who are fans of this stuff at our core. I know you're a huge Doctor Who fan, but you can't watch the new Doctor Who, and you would never make excuses for what it's become. because you know what's going on.
I'm too far gone. I mean, I'm well down there. I'm not at the level, at the page where we're still defending it. You know, I know what's going on completely, so I would never defend it. I mean, for the last, watching the new, like the revival of it from 2005 onwards, I was never defending it. I was just trying to get what enjoyment I could from it. And so, yeah, no one should think of me as a defender of this, for God's sake. Anyway, go on.
No, no. Well, I don't have much else to say about that, really. But if we're talking about this past decade, those types of movies have been everywhere. I mean, you can't go to the cinema without seeing like three or four Marvel films showing at one time. I remember when I was a kid, you know, Spider-Man might come out, and then 2 years later, a Superman film, Daredevil, maybe. Now it's like three or four every year, and you've got no escape from it. Disney, as a company, owns God knows how much of Hollywood. Just owns so many properties, and you can't escape it. It's this huge corporate takeover that everyone's trying to hope that, oh, it's going to get better. It's going to get better, but it's not. It's not going to get better. You're being played, and
yes,
you know.
Well, it is. I think it is interesting to see this betrayal and them, because I spoke about this on some hangout somewhere, and basically what you've got is a bunch of people who are de facto just liberals, just ordinary liberals, just run-of-the-mill kind of people, modern, I mean not classically liberal, I mean like just modern, ordinary people. And yeah. They're not dedicated progressives or whatever, but they would go along with it. Of course, they have no problem with gay marriage or whatever. They're definitely not racist. They don't care about immigration and so on. But then they find, and of course they would have attacked anyone who moaned about a black actor being in Doctor Who 10 years ago. Whatever, or 5 years ago, you know, they'd be going at that guy. Hey, come on, we don't need that shit in this fan base, kind of thing. And well, now these people are realizing that the program has gone way past their position on the spectrum, and it's now hardcore progressive, pushing trans, pushing everything, and they've been played, as you said earlier, and they feel betrayed.
Yeah, and
it's news to them.
Yeah, it's like for them it came out of nowhere. It's like whoa, what's happened here? Well, it's been a steady climb for years. I mean, you can see classic Disney movies now that, you know, the leads have been recast as minorities. So the upcoming Little Mermaid film, you know, Ariel's now a black woman, a strong female of color, and you know, I'm sure that'll be wonderful. You know, the new James Bond that's coming out. We all know what's going to happen in that. 007 is going to be a black woman, at least temporarily. And, you know, it's so easy, and I hate this argument. Like, everyone knows I hate this argument, but it's so easy to make the left or the real racist argument here. Because, you know, if you're going to play that game, you could say, well, it's racist because nobody has any intention of making a strong female black secret agent without ripping off the white one. So we're just giving them our scraps in a way, you know, because they're not worth a franchise of their own or whatever. But, you know, it's like I take it as a personal insult. And I'm not a huge James Bond fan. I don't give a shit about The Little Mermaid, but I take it as a huge insult because I just want to watch films where people look like me. I don't think I need to apologize for that, to be honest with you. Like, I don't think I need to apologize.
I think it's interesting because a lot of people like, and I'm going to use the example of Sargon, but I don't know if this does apply to him, but just people like him. 5 years ago, even three, 2 years ago, they would have laughed at some black person saying, I want black film stars. I want, you know, so that black kids have someone to look up to that they can identify with. I can imagine individualists saying, you don't need someone of your own race. You can identify with anyone. We're all individuals. It doesn't matter. Why do you care about this? Well, now, their kids are going to grow up in a world where there are no white role models. There are no the white guy in every film is going to be the loser, the angry, insecure bigot, and rapist, whatever, villain.
Rapist.
Not someone that you want to identify with and look up to and aspire to be like. So these people are going to have to deal with this, where their kids don't have anything to that they can identify with. Well, you know, now you understand why those black people 5 years ago were moaning that there weren't black. I mean, you can understand it now. Yes, you do want people who with whom you can identify so that you can look up to them. And it's not like looking up to someone foreign, basically.
No, I completely agree. I remember when a few years ago, I think it was, the Oscars So White controversy that was going on about 5 years ago or whatever. I remember back then, this was before I started my channel, thinking that, oh God, this is just identity politics gone mad. But now when you come to our position now in 2019, when you see all of this stuff happening to traditionally white characters, you think, actually, those people were right. You know, representation is very important to people. And it is important to people because people's ethnic and racial identity is very important to people. This is just a universal fact. I want to see films where, you know, there's a white guy as the hero. I mean, I'm sorry. It's just the way it is. It's not a hateful position to hold. The new Star Wars films, the only white guy in it is the villain. That's the truth. Other than Luke Skywalker, who's a fucking, you know, hermit on a planet who doesn't want to get involved in anything, like, pathetic. And you know, like, this is the way it is. And James Bond passing the torch to a strong black whatever, you know, black woman, you know, it's just like, come on, we get the idea now. Can we move on? Can we please just, you know, get past this? But you know, that's the way it is. I don't know how many films you've seen this year, Wars, how many times you've been to the cinema. I'm assuming not many.
Twice.
Well,
two times too many.
What did you see?
Midsummer and Doctor Sleep.
Oh, I wanted to see Midsummer. I didn't catch it though. Never mind. The other day, the weekend actually, I went to see Last Christmas, which is a Christmas film starring Game of Thrones Emilia Clarke. It's a rom-com. It wasn't my choice to go see it. It was the other half. She dragged me along, so blame her. But you talk about multicultural kind of leftist propaganda. I've never seen anything so blatant in the cinema for a long time. It's a rom-com, so you know, like the core audience will be women, young women. Every relationship, I'm not shitting you, every relationship in this film is multiracial. And the ones that aren't are dysfunctional. The main character has a sister who is a lesbian in the closet, and her girlfriend is, you guessed it, a black woman.
For fuck's sake.
Yes. The main character is a Eastern European refugee from Yugoslavia or something. And I think they've only done this because it would be too on the nose if they made them Syrian refugees. So they've done like an Eastern European thing. There's one scene where someone's watching a television and it's a leave means leave march on the news. And they say, they want to kick us all out. They want to kick us out of this country. And then there's a scene on a bus where a white, a straight white Cockney man turns around to some refugees on a bus and says, speak fucking English or get the fuck out. You know, I mean, it's just so bad. And of course, the main character is going out with an Asian guy and stuff. I mean, it's just, I was laughing in the cinema, but you know, you look around in the cinema and it's full of women and they're all eating it up because it's romantic. And it's just like, you know, it's like the Christmas adverts. Do you not understand what's going on here? But trying to sell like this interracial couple stuff to the mainstream is very difficult because they just think that you're a bigot and a horrible person if you bring it up, but it's everywhere.
Why would you object to this?
Yeah, what's the problem? Yeah. What's the problem?
Yeah.
But it's just fucking hell. I mean, it does grind on you, but I think it is rubbing off on a lot of people now.
I think you can say to them, it's propaganda. You know, their objection is, why would you object to this? Okay, it's not accurate of how real life is, sure, but even so, it's pushing a good message that we're all the same and we can all get along together. That's the sort of standard line here. What you could say is it's propaganda and it's anti-white, because have you noticed it's always a black guy with a white woman? I mean, that's a fact. And everyone can see that. I'm actually surprised that they're not being a bit more clever about this, you know, because it's always that combination. I mean, it's very obvious what... And when people deny that that's supposed to condition people? Of course it is. That's what advertising does. It's what all media does. People emulate what they see on the screen. But you can say that that's stupid of them. It doesn't matter. That's how people are. So
yeah,
this is all being done with that in mind, with that knowledge. So it's being done with an intention, which is to legitimize and popularize race mixing.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. But I just thought I'd bring that up because it's we were talking about pop culture there and Star Wars and all that. But, you know, personally, I'm looking forward to seeing all the YouTube reviews popping up for various things. Red Letter Media, I'm a fan of. I like watching them. I can't wait for them to put their trash review up of the new Star Wars film. But, you know, it's I don't think it's working as much. And that's another thing I'd say about this decade in particular. Most of the decade has been pushing this stuff big time, but towards the end, the last year or so, people have really been rejecting it. And you know, even I was listening to Laura Towler a few weeks ago, and she had a video with her grandmother, and I think her grandmother said that she'd noticed all this interracial stuff on TV on the Christmas adverts and things. And you know, if someone who isn't that politically engaged can see it, then how many other people are seeing it? You know, and this is, it's so in your face, and it's so obvious, and it's like the LGBT thing. It's so in your face. It's forced upon you that it's turning people against it now. Like, I never used it when I was younger. I never used to give a shit about LGBT or gay people or whatever. But now, if I want to watch a football game, I see the captain's armband is a rainbow flag. I see the corner flags as rainbow flags. I see, you know, the transitions on the TV edit as pride flags as well. And I'm thinking, why? What's this got to do with football? What's this got to do with anything? And yes, it turns people away from it. And that's where we're going,
like,
I think.
It's like nonstop political propaganda, as you would find in a totalitarian state, where every business, every organization, every local council, every football team has to show its allegiance to the state ideology. At this point, and I don't think that's even an exaggeration, I don't think I'm even caricaturing, at this point, the equality, diversity thing is so omnipresent that yes, you can never escape it. And as you say, it crops up in places where you simply wouldn't expect it. It's got no place being there.
Yeah, I know. And I, you know, it's, and then you get all these talking heads on TV saying, well, why did the Conservatives win this election? Why did Donald Trump get elected? Why did Brexit go through? And they never have any self-reflection. It's like, well, maybe all the shit that you're pushing has a detrimental effect on your goal, on what you want to achieve. I mean, can you not see that you're turning people off? And I love it personally. I love it. I've decided, you know, there used to be a time a couple of years ago where I was very combative. I used to try and, you know, fight these people on a day-to-day basis. But now I just think, let them get on with it. Just let them get on with it, because the more they do it, the more they will lose. Slowly and surely. I mean, it's like those people who were rioting outside of Downing Street when Boris won the election. It's like,
yeah,
keep doing it, guys. Keep doing it. I'm sure the working class and, you know, the people who, the boiler guys up here where I live, they're going to be really inspired by what you're doing. They're going to totally change their minds after seeing you on the news. You know,
I
great job.
This is something, this is true. I mean, I think that Antifa are so active. You know, I think ordinary people must see a massive disparity between how the far right behaves and how the far left behaves. It's fucking glaringly obvious that the far left are the violent ones. I mean, what you get is the occasional right-wing loner, like the guy who killed Joe Cox.
Right.
You don't get mass violence and rioting from the far right, or from, and I don't even like using that term, because I don't really, I mean, it's a negative, it's a term that has been turned into a complete negative, but also I'm not really convinced that it's even accurate. I mean, people would call me far right, they would call you far right. I don't feel it's accurate. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, I'm not the first person to say this, obviously, but I think the left and right sort of definitions are kind of redundant now. I think you were talking to Black Pigeon Speaks yesterday, and he made the same point. It is just nationalism and globalism at this point. And there's variations between those two things, but left and right, I mean, it's an easy way to define people on the surface if you want to get a point across quickly. But in reality, if you're going to kind of dissect them, they're not really that accurate to describe people anymore. You know, there's so many variations of belief within those two sides. But you know, it's just a sign of the times. Everything's becoming more nuanced now. You know, back in the day, you know, it was back in the day, if you were right wing, you knew what you supported. Now, not really, not really. There's left wingers, there's socialists who support Brexit now. And yes, that's been framed in the media that it's a particularly right wing ideology, but it's not. It's across the board. You've just got to recognize what's what now. I think it's very exciting, personally. I think it's the more out of confusion and complication comes opportunity, I think. So I'm very excited about the next decade in regards to that.
Yeah, I think that it's, we, in a sense, we can just let Antifa disgrace themselves because they seem not to have any the self-reflection that would prevent them from doing so.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Another thing about this decade, I don't know if anyone's mentioned this on Millennials so far, but one thing that's come into my focus particularly, and something that I think is going to be more prominent in the next decade or so, is cryptocurrency. Now, one of my subscribers turned me on to crypto, and I'm not an expert by any means. And if anyone says they're an expert in cryptocurrency, they're fucking lying, because nobody knows anything about it, really. It's so volatile. But I'm reading news that the Chinese government are developing their own cryptocurrency, and all of these governments around the world are adopting it. And I think, you know, the financial world is going to go through many, many changes in the coming years, and crypto is going to be at the forefront of that. And a lot of people just think, oh, Bitcoin, it was a way for people to get rich quick. It was a Ponzi scheme or whatever. It's a scam. But no, there's thousands of different types of cryptocurrency that have been adopted all over the world. And I think people are not ready for the ways that this is going to change the world and the things that we know, the financial institutions that we all rely on. Things are going to change dramatically. And this is what I'd like to bring up. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on it, but this is something that I've been delving into in the last couple of months.
I mostly just listen to other people talking about crypto. I've got a friend who's really into it professionally. I mean, he's into the whole blockchain stuff and all that.
Yeah.
So, but I can't fathom it, and so I just listen to other people. I mean, I could. I'm sure I could fathom it if I took the time, but I don't have the time. So, why don't you tell us? Obviously not the technical stuff. How do you think it's going to change the world? What things are we going to see as commonplace 10 years from now that, you know, are new?
Well, I think, for example, Bitcoin, if we can take that as an example. So practically, Bitcoin doesn't really have that much usage. It doesn't have a real world use insofar as, like, you know, you can go into Starbucks and pay for a coffee using Bitcoin, but one Bitcoin is worth at the moment like $7,000 or something. It's a digital store of wealth. And I think there's going to be a move to kind of replace these, or not replace, but at least compete with these physical stores of wealth like gold and precious metals with digital assets. And along with that, I think you look at China and what they're trying to do with cryptocurrency. I think the world economy is going to really move into this space. And Black Pigeon Speaks yesterday was talking about the U.S. Federal Reserve printing money, like $500 billion a month, just printing money and putting it into circulation. I mean, this has consequences. And people are saying, I'm not an expert, but people are saying that crypto can be the next step, with fiat currency kind of running its course and, you know, more financial crashes or what have you. That's the way the global finances are going to go. And I think it's a very interesting space. Nobody really knows anything. And I'm just a hobbyist. Like, I'm not an expert or anything. I just read what I read. I listen to a few people. But it's something to think about. And a lot of people are going to be caught out by this, I think. A lot of people. And if you talk about social unrest, I think this is going to be one of the contributing factors to something like that. I don't really have anything else to say. I just thought I'd mention it in case anyone's interested. Do your own research. I think it's very, very interesting.
Right. I think it is as well, in the sense that the people who know about it seem to be very excited about it. Like, they seem to think it's really going to change the world. And it tends to be people who are intelligent and clever and thoughtful, so I sort of trust their judgment. But as for, I don't know much about it. I do have a Bitcoin wallet, an Ethereum wallet, and so on. So I do receive it now and then, but I don't know much about it. But yeah, I'm interested to see how it, if it does change the world, and in what ways it does. I mean, some people say it bypasses all the authorities, so you can't, you know, be a way for us to be sustained, you know, once so many other platforms have defunded us. I hope that's true. I do hope that's true.
I think that was the original hope with something like Bitcoin, but I think what you're seeing now is global financial institutions are now going into crypto. You know, they saw it as a threat, and now they're getting involved. So it's like, you know, it's like the institutions we're trying to fight are just playing us at our own game. And I just find it really interesting. I'm not making predictions here or there. I just find it very interesting. And I think, you know, in the future, I think, you know, in 20 years time, I think the notion of having a pound coin or a dollar is going to be quite antiquated. I think the digital space is going to be really, really prevalent in a lot of people's lives. And I just suggest that everyone does their own research and kind of looks into it, because it's very interesting. What can I say? Very interesting.
Somebody has said it's about taking away cash so that they will be able to turn your money off.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Who knows? That I'm not ruling that out at all. Yeah. It's such an unknown area. I mean, anything's possible, really. It's exciting and scary at the same time. And that's all I can really say.
Yeah, no, exactly. It is an unknown quantity at this point. So is there anything else that you'd want to say about this decade, the 2010s, that is about to end in 12 days' time?
I think I've said everything I've wanted to say about... Hello?
Yes. Don't worry, you're here.
Oh, okay. I think I've said everything I want to say about the sort of the social media and internet viral aspect of it. Politically, everyone knows what I think of all the big political issues of this decade. I'm much on the same lines as what you think. In terms of the future, I think we're going to really kind of continue on the path we're on now. I think it's going to be just a more just future nationalism. I think that's going to take over what we're doing now. It's like we said earlier, left and right are very old fashioned. It's nationalism versus globalism. It's a very much an us and them mentality now. Divisiveness. And I think division is good. I think division is good because it means that something's been fought for. Something's at stake. It's if everything was kind of, you know, middle of the road and getting on as normal, I think we're in a bad place. But division, I feel, is very exciting.
Well, that's something that's interesting, because I was saying on the last night on one of the streams that I think the 2000s didn't have division. It didn't have any big political crisis or conflict that two sides could argue over. I think that really only started right. But this decade definitely has. And I don't know where you would trace the origins of this to. In Britain, we had the Equality Act in, I think, 2005-06. But really, it's about Silicon Valley and the SJWs taking over things, which I know goes back to like 2013, 2014. But doubtless there were things before even that. And at any rate, the SJW emerged, progressivism emerged, and then other things emerged in opposition to that. The centrist free speech advocate, libertarian, you might say nihilist, and then another response on the right. So I think there's been a lot more political division and flavor in this decade than in the previous one, which was really just a dead zone, I think.
Yeah, I can't really remember what happened in the 2000s. Obviously, I was a bit younger, obviously.
Not much.
I mean, when you're younger, you're more self-absorbed. You don't really take much notice of the world around you. But even so, I can't. I mean, the Iraq War, you know, Middle Eastern conflicts, I guess that's what defined that decade. And even on the subject of that, I mean, the public have become so opposed to that sort of thing. Not that they weren't back then. I mean, we all remember the massive march in London against the Iraq War that Tony Blair and his government completely ignored.
Yeah, I was
on it. Fuck all you people. You were on it, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, people didn't want that to happen, but they did it anyway. And I think, you know, something like that now, prospect of war in the Middle East would be even more unpopular now because we know where it leads. You know, and there's also, you know, we're not going to mention the big problem in the Middle East, but, you know, it's a con in the end of the day, isn't it? It's there's no benefit to us.
Someone's saying, I think they mean the 90s, not the 2000s. No, I am talking about the 2000s. I think the 2000s was, a dead zone politically. There really wasn't much going on. I was, you know, a young guy throughout that. I was like, how old was I? I was like 18, 17, 17 when in the year 2000 when it started. And so, yeah, I saw it all as a young person. And I was at art college, two different art colleges, and there was really no politics. It just wasn't there. Obviously, it was there. Of course, it was there at an art college. the cultural Marxism was absolutely there in the curriculum. But it wasn't like, I mean, I remember two girls at my first art college. Two girls decided one day that they would do a feminist thing. And they made T-shirts that said, I will not be a slave. That was it. These two girls did that. That was their action. And everyone just thought it was completely naff, which it was. But nowadays, it wouldn't be two girls doing that. It would be 20, 30, 40 girls doing that. Yeah. And it wouldn't. And no guy would say it was naff because, you know, he'd want to get laid. So it's nowadays, there's a whole other dimension to it. Back then, it was just, you know, it was laughable. There wasn't politics there.
I completely agree. Yeah, if that was to happen today, all the girls, by the way, would be topless as well. They'd have, like, you know, felt tip pens on their boobs and stuff. And yeah, I mean, that's something we can talk about, this sort of decline in dominant masculinity at the same time, because, you know, back then, I mean, there'd be a few, but most guys would just kind of laugh at that sort of stuff. But now a lot of guys would be sympathetic towards it, or outwardly sympathetic, because they want to get social credit and they want to impress these women.
Yeah, someone's just said those men don't get laid, they watch the bull do it.
That's true. And that's true.
Someone else said, Alex DeLarge said, it's the 2000s seem quaint and innocent compared to today. I mean, back then it was kind of, I would say, just an empty decade, really. That's the way it is in my mind. This decade is fucking full of frenetic activity. The 2000s is just this big sort of 10 years of nothing much, and no sort of flavor, nothing to characterize it. And Alex makes the point that nowadays we're castrating little boys and putting them on estrogen, which is true. I mean, there's a demonic, terrifying aspect to the current year, which, I mean, you know, Desmond is amazing and all that. It goes back to, I think that was 2017 when he first appeared. And you know, it is scary in a way that the 2000s was just like the pause before the lull, the calm before the storm.
Yeah, it was a very transitional decade, wasn't it? I mean, I remember I didn't have the internet until I was about 15 years old. And, you know, I remember a time before the internet was widespread. I mean, you know, my family had a computer, but I was only allowed on the internet for an hour a week, and you had to dial up, and it was, you know, that awful sound, like, you know, you had to do it, and every website was slow. You couldn't load a bloody picture without waiting for 20 minutes. And suddenly, in the middle of the 2000s, everyone sort of got broadband. And I remember when my family got broadband, it was like my world changed overnight. It was very weird.
It was fantastic. I couldn't believe the change it made. Suddenly you could just do things that previously were nightmarishly long-winded.
And oh, yes, yes.
Possible, like downloading films and stuff like that. Not that I'm advocating such things.
Of course not, no. Definitely don't download the new Star Wars film. Don't do that. It's shite.
If you do, certainly don't watch it. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. But yeah, so, I mean, it's... I mean, now, as the years go by, the next decade that's coming up, I mean, virtual reality, I think, is going to be a huge thing. More and more people getting sort of trapped in the online world and negating the real world. We've already got virtual reality video games, for Christ's sake, and they're quite engaging. I mean, what if mundane real life was turned into virtual reality? Just like, oh, you want a girlfriend? Here's a virtual reality girlfriend for you. You know, you don't have to go out and meet your actual woman. Here you go. I can see that coming in big time. I think it's already a thing in Japan, actually. Lots of Japanese guys are going out with virtual girlfriends on video games. It's crazy.
That is just, I can't see that as anything other than profoundly unhealthy. Call me an old stickler, whatever, an old fart, but come on, that cannot be right.
No, it can't be. And, you know, obviously with the widespread accessibility of pornography, I mean, you marry the two together and you've got a recipe for disaster, really, don't you? It's quite incredible. But I think that's where we're going. I mean, there is an increasing divide between the real world and the virtual world, despite there being, as I said earlier, a bit of a backlash to that. In the latter years of this decade. But I think you can't really stop technological advancement, can you? And it's exciting to a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. Somebody's just suggested that a good nickname for this, for the 2010s, would be the Tranny Tens.
Yeah, that's true. The Tranny Tens, yes. Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know what a tranny was 10 years ago, and now I'm surrounded by the fucking...
You know, it occurred to me... 20 years ago, a tranny, it was something that you heard about, you know, in the 90s. It was something that you heard about every few months, if that. Yeah. And it was usually something a bit funny. Some guy, you know, you'd hear some story. It wasn't anything that people took seriously. Everyone, it was, whether it's the drag queen bar or some silly thing that the rugby squad are doing for the charity thing. That's all it was. It was just something silly. Or it was some tragic person who actually had a gender dysmorphic disorder, whatever the term is. It was something sad. In the case that it was something real, it was something tragic and sad. But most of all, it was something that you rarely encountered back then. Now it's everywhere and all the time. I mean, every single day there's something in the news about the trans issue, and this strikes me as completely unnatural and unnecessary. I think it I mean, you know, what I'm saying is very obvious boomer take here, but yeah, it's something that's being manufactured completely.
Absolutely. On the subject of that, in Newcastle every year, the Lady Boys of Bangkok come around, you know, this tour. They have this big truck with all these pictures of these transgender guys on the side. And, you know, back in the day, that would have just been a funny stag do, you know, all these guys.
Here's a revelation for some people.
Have you been Lady Boys of Bangkok?
Yeah.
Yes.
This will be clipped. in Edinburgh, a long time ago, yes, I went to a show of the Lady Boys of Bangkok, and but you know, it was just something. What can I say? It was the '90s, or maybe the early 2000s. I can't remember. But yeah, it was. I can't remember anything about it. One of them was eyeing me up. That's literally all I can remember about the whole thing. I know maybe my drink was spiked. So, but yeah, it was just nothing. It was just something that was something funny. I mean, everyone just thought it was kind of, you know, silly and weird, whatever. But yeah, most of all, it was just something you hardly ever encountered. It was a novelty. But I really feel, and I think a lot of folk agree on this, that it's something that a lot of people find uncomfortable. The sheer omnipresence of it now is something that troubles a lot of people, because it's not happening naturally, and it is something that threatens a fundamental aspect of life, which is, you know, the concepts of male and female.
Oh, absolutely. What you said there about, you know, reality and whether things are genuine or not. I mean, that's a hilarious story, by the way, about you going to the Lady Boys of Bangkok.
There's nothing to it. Some people are talking in the chat. There's nothing to it. It's just that loads of guys did that. I mean, it was just something that people did, and women. You know, it was just like going to the circus or something. You know, it was just a funny thing that stag do's, hen nights, that kind of stuff. Folk went to it. So, yeah, I saw it once. But as I say, I can't remember anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've known loads of people who've gone to that on stag do's, like I said, or just like, you know, stupid drunken birthday parties. But on the subject of things being genuine or not, I on my 18th birthday, I remember this so vividly. A friend of mine took me to a strip club in Newcastle, like a strip club with women, nothing funny going on, just a strip club, like, you know, normal. And even that I found very weird and kind of disconcerting because it wasn't genuine. You know, you're sitting at the bar and all of these very attractive women come up to you and try and sweet talk you into going to do a lap dance. And you're thinking, hang on, you're not into me. This is bullshit, isn't it? Like, you only pay 50 quid for a fucking lap dance. It's like, it's the same thing, but on the other side of the spectrum in terms of the lady boys of Bangkok. It's just, it's a novelty, isn't it? It's not real. It's really funny to me. Like, I think these fake experiences are kind of getting rejected now, actually. People want authenticity these days.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, I've got Jared Taylor coming on in 23 minutes. I doubt we'll be talking about this topic with him. So, in the meantime, is there anything else you'd like to say about predictions for the next 10 years, the next decade, the 2020s?
Oh, God. I mean, I don't know. I think I don't have anything original to say here. I think it's going to be very similar to this past decade, actually. I think it's going to be, politically at least, it's going to be the same as what we've seen for the last 3 or 4 years. Just amplified. I think there's going to be a backlash against social media. I wouldn't be surprised to see some social media companies fold or kind of lose their dominance. I'm looking at Twitter specifically.
Good. We both have a vendetta against Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, what will replace them is anyone's guess, but I don't think they're going to have the same sort of influence in 10 years' time as they do now, for example. And you know what? I mean, like I said, the Boris Johnson election that just happened, everyone on Twitter who was so, you know, in that bubble have just been made to look like fools. And they've realized that Twitter just isn't reality. And so what real value can be put in it? I think it's going to devolve. I think it's going to shrivel up. And I think we're going to have to find something else. But very interesting times ahead, I have to say. Very interesting.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Okay, well, we'll move on to the Super Chat. Someone's asking, what's the point of entropy if questions are ignored? They're not going to be ignored. I've left it till the end. So, here's one from someone. I wouldn't read out the name. Has Dan ever had a pint with Morgoth? If not, why not? And he should do another of his pub interviews with Morgoth.
No, I haven't. I would like to. We were talking actually a couple of months ago. We made a loose arrangement to have a pint together, but it never really happened. So I need to kind of, it's my fault really. I dropped the ball. I things got in the way. So I will get back in touch with him and sort that out. I'd like to record a podcast with the guy. I think he's very, very insightful. And he's one of my favorite content creators on YouTube. So yeah.
Okay. Someone's asking, when is Morgoth going to be on? Have a look at the schedule. That you don't need to ask that question. It's there in the schedule. Okay, now here's an interesting question that was put to somebody else last night. Okay. Your opinions on the demise of Tommy Robinson?
Oh, interesting. Well, first of all, is he going through a demise, or is it just what we like to think he's going through? Because yes. Obviously, I am on the side of the people he's attacking, because I think Tommy Robinson and the people who are working with him have done their best to skewer what nationalism means into their own agenda. But he's still a very popular man, isn't he? And that's the problem that we have. I mean, him promoting Israel and Zionism, it's a hard sell for us to kind of convince the working class that they shouldn't be concerned about that, because Tommy Robinson is a working class hero, isn't he? I mean, if what he says goes. But I do agree that he's really dropped the ball lately, and it's infuriating, actually. And I guess a lot of people have been proven right about what they said about him from the start.
Okay, yes, I agree. Someone said he has been totally deplatformed and Mark Collett has been trying to take him down. I don't think it's a personal beef of Mark's. I think it's that, on the contrary, it's that Team Tommy, whatever you want to call it. What's it called? TR?
Whatever it is. Something like that.
They attacked Mark Collett. And so he responded. It's perfectly reasonable. I think it is in a sense that he is going through a demise. Now, whether I think he'll survive it, but I think his credibility and it has been tarnished. And I think his following is being, basically they're realizing that it's all been a bit of it's not going to go anywhere. And it's been a holding pen for them.
Yes.
Even though I don't think Tommy Robinson intended it as such, I think the people around him intended it as a holding pen. On the matter of him being totally deplatformed, yes, he has been, and I'm against that. I think it's terrible. I think it's awful. It's wrong that he was banned from Twitter, Facebook, that YouTube have... I think he's still got a YouTube channel, but it's completely fenced in. I don't know what the word is. There's a ring fence.
If you search for it, you can't... I tried to find it the other day, and I couldn't find it, so...
Yeah, you actually have to have the direct link to his channel. Yeah. And I mean, it's just ridiculous. And completely indefensible. So I'm not supporting that at all. I think it's terrible. And with that in mind, it's a shame for people to, in a way, it's a shame for people to attack him because he doesn't have as much ability to respond. However, we have seen his responses and they are moronic, I'm afraid. Yes. Like, you can't, I mean, there's no need for me to go into it and repeat what other people have said. The point is, even if he could respond, the things he would be saying, well, the things he is saying, are stupid. He's lost. I think that this is why I say his credibility is gone. I think the disinfectant sunlight has exposed him as a grifter and a shell, even though he is brave. I mean, this is the thing. I was never against him with the venom that a lot of people were against him. You know, I think that he did serve a purpose. I think that his intentions were honourable to an extent. But I also think he was limited and a bit lazy and ultimately gullible. And I think he's been used.
Yeah, I think a lot of people made the mistake of thinking of Tommy Robinson as some sort of political leader. He's not that. He's someone who draws attention to certain issues in the country, and that's about it. But I agree with you. His response to Mark Collett and Laura Taylor on Twitter was just juvenile. You know, it's just like, what did he say? He said, "There's people criticizing me. They don't even have kids. Have sex.
Irrelevant.
You virgins. Irrelevant. You know, do this." I mean, it's just like, it's so childish. It's like, this doesn't make any sense. We don't need to be in a breeding competition with immigrants, for fucks. That's not what it's about.
And even if we could be, the fact that someone doesn't have kids doesn't mean that they can't be bothered about these issues. Exactly. So just, you know, it's just a stupid, puerile way to try to discredit people. And also he used the example of, his statistics were wrong about the future demographics of, was it Luton or Leicester? I can't remember which town it was. He was just simply wrong about it. You know, the black percentage is going to massively grow and the white percentage is going to halve in size. So, you know, he was just wrong about that. But yeah, we can go into all of that. It's not really necessary because other people have done it elsewhere.
Sorry to interrupt. I think Morgoth had it right when he said that Tommy Robinson is just a liberal who doesn't like Islam. I think that's basically a good summary of him. There's a lot of people like that.
Yeah. One other thing I would say is he is brave. And I think when we condemn him as a gatekeeper and a bit silly and all that, I think it's also important to be fair and say this guy has gone to jail. He has been in physical danger, probably mortal danger. He has suffered. He got his teeth kicked, knocked out. He is at threat. So I want to just bear that in mind. I want to point that out because it's not fair to deny him that, you know, because he has made huge sacrifices and he is in the media spotlight all the time. So his life is not one that I would want, you know, might be one that I get given time. I don't know, but it's not, but he's given a lot. So I think that should be acknowledged. I think it's only fair.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not going to jump on this sort of Tommy hating bandwagon that's going on now. You can check my channel for the last 3 years. I've made several videos defending the guy, and you know, he has been a big part of me coming to where I am now on the spectrum. It's just the way it is. When I was younger, I used to believe the BBC about him being a horrible Nazi or whatever, a huge bigot, a fascist, whatever. And then you listen to the bloke and you get sort of red pilled on the Islam stuff, and then you move on. I mean, he's a stepping stone as far as I'm concerned. But I mean, and he is brave. I agree with you, but you know, it is juvenile what's going on right now. Very, very juvenile. And I just think that some of the people that are in his camp have very specific agendas. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah. And then there's the grugs who've been doing videos to Laura Taylor and so on, which are just,
oh yeah, yeah.
Just very low IQ.
Just gay, isn't it?
Yeah, silly stuff. Okay, I'll move on to another one. Don't you just find it insulting that we've gone from having bands like Muse, Radiohead, Led Zeppelin and the Smiths, etc., headlining Glastonbury, to degenerates like Stormzy?
Yeah. Yeah, basically. Although, yeah. I have to say, I've never been a huge fan of big sort of concerts. It was never a thing in my life. When I was growing up, I always used to be a film guy. I used to love films, and all my friends were like band nerds who would go to gigs and stuff, and I would always just like watch movies. But yeah, I mean, I just the decline of rock music in general, it's very noticeable.
Yeah,
I mean, who's the biggest rock band in the world right now? I can't even tell you. Is there one?
I don't know. I read once that Britpop in the mid-90s was the last gold rush for the music industry, and I think that's probably true. I mean, I don't really know how people make loads of money off music nowadays.
I don't think they do. I think they just tour, don't they, if they're popular enough.
And I think so. I think that's how they make money now, which is obviously a lot more work involved. okay, two super chats. If anyone wants to post super chats, do it right now, because I'm going to have to end this one very soon in order to make way for Jared Taylor. Okay, what did you guys think about the Australian KFC commercial? Now, I did hear about this, but I can't remember what it was. Okay, can you remember this, Dan?
I don't know anything about this, actually. I'm clueless.
If someone can remind me in the live chat, because I did see it in the last week. This is a good example of how fast life moves now, that I can't remember what it actually was. But it was something, I think it was something LGBT-ish.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Because chicken can be gay as well, you know.
Yeah. See, the only other thing I know about the KFC commercials is that RoboCop, and it was actually the actor, Peter Weller, did some KFC commercials as RoboCop.
Fuck me.
Yeah, they got the original actor back. It's very strange. Okay, it's a white woman kissing a black guy. Okay, so it wasn't LGBT, it was the race mixing. Wonderful. Yeah.
Can I just say, RoboCop is an incredible film, and if you haven't seen it, anyone, you should watch it, the original. Just go do it. It's incredible.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's one of my favorite films. Okay, and the only other super chat is, things have gotten exponentially worse in the 2010s. Will the Western world become the Weimar Republic in the 2020s? Especially once Trump is out of office in 2024, most likely.
I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know. It's the thing about Trump getting out of office. We all agree that he's got his deficiencies, right? But right now, in the American political landscape, he's probably the best we're going to get. I don't know who's going to come after him. I don't know who the Republicans are going to put up after him, because they can't go back to the sort of the bullshit establishment Republicans like Ted Cruz or whatever. They've got to kind of continue down the same route, right? So that's a question mark for me. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think, as I was saying with Sargon last night, I think that they are locked into a course and they have to keep going down this. They can't admit that they were wrong at this stage. It's got to be a suicide mission for the left, for the progressives.
Yeah, I mean,
they're not going. It's not just suicide for them, though. They're going to take down society with them. That's the trouble.
I mean, I put it this way, I can't imagine Jeb Bush making a huge comeback. You know, it's like, I don't know if that's going to be the way they're going to go. They've got to continue down the populist.
Sorry. I thought you were referring to the progressive of the left. Oh, no, the mainstream Republicans. I don't know what will happen, because it might be that they learn the lesson from Trump and decide to go the populist route. Or I don't know, it depends, because I don't know enough about American politics and the political establishment in America to comment on this. So I'm not sure.
I think when we talk about America, the biggest, you know, the unavoidable thing is the demographic situation. You know, I mean, everything hinges on that. Their demographic situation is worse than ours. And it's really scary, actually. And, you know, you've got the New York Times and all of the major publications over there longing for the demographics to flip, because, you know, Texas will turn blue, and then all of a sudden, like, the Republicans will never win an election ever again. And, you know, you've got to consider that before making any predictions about anything in America. So, I mean, maybe, I don't know, I mean, unless the wall gets built, I don't know what you're going to say. I mean, it really does depend on the short term, at least, on that. If Trump doesn't build the wall, then he's a failure, big time. He can increase the stock market or whatever, but build the fucking wall. Mm-hmm. If not, then what's the point in anything?
Yeah. Yes, I agree. All right, so let's leave it there. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to say, Dan the Iconoclast?
No, nothing comes to mind. I'd just like to say it's been very fun. Merry Christmas to everyone in the chat and to you, Woz. I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season and a happy new year. Very successful. And hopefully we've still got our channels next year so we can do this again. If not, maybe BitChute has live streaming set up by this time next year. And then we'll just do it there.
I think it will. So yeah, we'll just do it there. So thank you very much. Merry Christmas to you too, Dan. And all right, thank you for doing this. It's been quite a substantial one and I've really enjoyed this one. Okay, thank you, Dan. Thank you, everyone. I'll be back soon with Jared Taylor. See you all then.
Great.